1, 2, 3, break.
Down the middle of the field, it is caught.
Loose football. Who's got it?
Down at the 1 yard line.
How about that?
That is the ultimate kibosh.
And we are underway.
Hello, everyone. Welcome back to another episode of the Action Network NFL Podcast. I'm Matthew Friedman, the editor-in-chief of Fantasy Labs. And with me for a special mailbag episode for everyone out there grinding fantasy football, even though it is the offseason, we have Sean Corner and Chris Raybon. Sean is the Action Network Director of Predictive Analytics and one of the top in-season fantasy pros rankers for the past half decade. And Chris is a senior editor and analyst at the Action Network and a co-host of I'll Take That Bet on ESPN+. You can follow them in the Action Network app at @_oddsmaker and Chris Raybon. Use the app, of course, to get real-time odds and track your bets. Gentlemen, we are starting to get into the podcast groove. Last week, we released our top 200 fantasy football rankings at the Action Network, and we previewed them on the show. This week, we are giving the people what they want and answering all of their fantasy questions. How are you guys doing?
I'm doing good. I just put my chair on stiff, so it's not gonna. Hopefully, it's not squeaking around all show. So if you guys hear some squeaky chair, you know I'm really excited about a player because my chair is kind of sturdy right now.
Yeah, Sean, how is your chair over there?
Yeah, I can't commit to that. I still have the same chair from last year, but I will be getting one before the start of the season.
Wasn't there supposed to be a chair upgrade?
Yeah, it's too soon for that, though. I guess right about now is when I was planning on getting it. So this might be the last pod with this chair. Who knows?
Oh, that would be a good way to send out the chair. Yeah. Send it out in high style. Okay, here's a question. Do you prefer it when I ask directly, how's it going? Like, Sean, how's it going? And then Chris, how's it going? So that there's more direction. Or do you prefer it when I just throw up a question, like a jump ball, and let you two compete to fill the empty audio space?
Yeah, I like the jump ball because, you know, whoever has the most going on can answer first.
I really had this chair thing going for me, and I felt the need to just kind of jump in, you know, got my ups over Sean, but I'm sure he'll be back next week with something equally interesting.
Yeah, I hope he doesn't have anything less interesting than your chair. Okay, let's jump into it, start hitting these questions. We have a lot of questions to get through. All right, number one from Gavin. I have the number one pick. Is Saquon really the guy? One of you. See, this is why I asked the question.
I thought that was just for the opening question. I didn't know you were going to not ask.
This is why I asked. I just wanted to see.
Okay, yes. Saquon is the guy. Saquon, I don't see why not. I think I would be fine with Zeke there at number one as well, because I think that there's a few teams out there that still have shown a relative commitment to wanting to feed their backs, and I think Saquon and Zeke kind of top that list. Christian McCaffrey, I don't think is a horrible choice there, but I think they might want to scale his workload back a tiny bit. And then there are some other guys that I think have that RB1 overall upside that I wouldn't call you crazy if you took number one. It's just a little bit more uncertainty, guys like David Johnson and Le'Veon Bell, who have kind of showed that in the past.
Yeah, I agree. If I have first pick, I'm taking Barkley. I'm not really tinkering with it too much right now. You might consider Zeke, but you know, if I'm given the first pick, I'm just taking Barkley at this point in the season.
I mean, I will say, Raybon, to kind of push back, in our rankings, you actually have Zeke ahead of Saquon. do you care to address that at all?
So it's just they're really equal. It's just Zeke, I think his touchdown upside is still a little bit greater. So he's just kind of – his projection is kind of maybe a couple of tenths ahead of Barkley, but that, you know, that's nothing where I would, you know, really worry about. I don't sweat in general. This is my advice. Don't sweat the number one pick, especially if you have first overall. Like, it's literally the least important pick of the whole draft probably for you, because if you do whiff on it, it's going to be more so just bad luck than anything you could have predicted. The guys are up there for a reason.
All right. What are the projections by the pros on Gurley? Sean, I want to kick this to you.
All right, since that's such a specific question, I'll just tell you what I have right now for his projections. So I have 240 carries, 1,065 rushing yards, 11 touchdowns, 51 receptions, 450 receiving yards, and 3 receiving touchdowns. So that, you know, he comes in as my 6th running back with those. But I've been advocating to not draft him there just because there's so much hidden downside in drafting Gurley right now. You know, the Rams kept Malcolm Brown. They drafted Daryl Henderson in the third round. So, you know, his knee might not be 100% this year. So they could scale back his carry significantly or even miss time if it flares up during the season. So, you know, kind of going back to what Raybon was saying, your first pick shouldn't be – there shouldn't be any massive downside at all. You're just trying to take high upside guys. And, you know, Gurley is unfortunately one of those guys with just a really low floor. So I'm pretty much avoiding him in the first round. Now, you know, having said that, over the summer, you know, the drafts, his ADP might fall somewhere in the second round. And, you know, I think around then I would consider taking him. But for right now, my median projections for him have him in the first round, but I'm still passing on him due to this hidden floor he has.
Yeah. And as you mentioned, the Rams drafted Daryl Henderson, actually traded up to draft him. So that's not a great sign there. Chris, any thoughts on this?
Yeah, I'll just give my, because I think, you know, Sean gave his full season projection. So I'll just give my per game one, since I think there will be a lot of, you know, there's a lot of different ways you could project, you know, games missed for every player. So mine are 14.1 carries, 61 yards, 0.56 rushing touchdowns, 4.5 targets, 3.3 catches, 28 receiving yards, and 0.17 receiving touchdowns. So depending on how many games you project, that will kind of, you know, give you your full season. And yeah, Daryl Henderson, rookie running back drafted in the third round over the since 2011, are averaging 137 touches per season. So that kind of gives you an idea of how much Henderson could kind of cut into that work. But I think Malcolm Brown was brought back and on that offer sheet matched more so as a direct backup to Gurley, because McVay kind of talked about working out all of the change of pace backs at receiver, and Henderson was one of those guys, and he said he wanted to use Dunbar in that kind of role. He never stayed healthy. So that what that tells me is that, you know, Henderson's going to be kind of not necessarily just a direct backup, but also that Kayvon Austin is trash.
Are Hopkins and Adams the number one and number two wide receiver?
Yes. And I don't think the order really matters. I mean, if I had 100 drafts, I'd probably go with Hopkins 53% of the time and Adams 47% of the time. Ideally, I want to get a pick later in the first round and just get whichever guy falls to me and then be in better position to snag Travis Kelce. But I mean, again, with the first round, you can't really go wrong with these guys. But if I had to lean on any particular one, to be Hopkins for now.
Yeah, Raybon, you feel the same way?
Yeah, it's pretty much 50-50 for me. Kind of the same thing with running back. There's no reason to sweat that pick too much. I think Hopkins has shown what he can do with poor quarterbacks. And then the advantage of Adams is that I still don't think Rodgers is going to trust many of these guys, even in year two. I mean, he's all about trust. And if you just look at how much he targeted Adams, especially in the red zone, compared to how much he targeted his other receivers, it was just not even close.
Yeah, I have Beckham, I think, as my number two guy. That's probably a little aggressive. I might need to rethink that a little bit, but I'm still pretty bullish on him.
I think I'd probably
go with Hopkins and Beckham as the top two guys.
I don't know how far along you are in your projections of like games missed, but Beckham is a little bit, I think, of a greater injury risk than those guys. Anyone have any opinion on that?
Yeah, he is. Yeah. He definitely is.
Because a lot of his injuries have been soft tissue, right? So you know, things like that you would consider to be more reoccurring than others. I'm just waiting for Raybon's injury study to have a final say on that. But he seems to have just a little more risk than these guys. So, I mean, he's still, you know, could be the number two receiver. So I still have my top five, but I just rather have these stable guys that have, you know, proven over the last couple of years they can stay healthy as well.
Yeah, he's higher in my per game than my season long.
All right, who is the one player you expect to surprise everybody and be this year's fantasy darling, i.e. last year's version of Philip Lindsay or Patrick Mahomes? I tell you what, this is a good question. Let's save this one for the end of the show. That's what we call a tease in the business. Okay, next one. Who is the one first rounder by ADP you're looking to fade? I'm assuming, Sean, for you, that's Gurley. Raybon, do you have any opinion on this one?
Yeah, that's who I was going to say too. It's Gurley. I wrote about this in my 10 players I'm fading over at theactionnetwork.com/NFL. And, you know, he was the first guy. I just think that, as Sean mentioned, he's the one guy that you could really pick out that has a lower floor, that we're aware of. You know, every running back has a certain type of floor because of their position with the greatest amount of injury risk. They have the most high impact collisions. But Gurley, beyond that, just has a little more because we know about the knee condition. We see the Rams kind of taking precautions and getting guys in place behind them.
All right, kind of in that same vein, and this one is asked from Matt in Cedar Rapids, a really good-looking guy, I've heard. Who is the one second-rounder you want to draft?
For me, it would be, it always depends on your draft position. You can't really, you know, whatever you're slotted at, you kind of have a bucket of three or four guys you can actually have access to. But the guy I'm hoping for at almost any point in round two is Travis Kelce. I've talked about it before, but the drop-off at tight end is so severe that, you know, I like to lock up one of the top three tight ends. And, you know, I have Travis Kelce a little bit higher than Zach Ertz too. So I think Kelsey's almost in a tier by himself. So locking in tight end in round two, I think is a huge advantage. So he's the one guy I would hope would fall to me at any point in round two.
Yeah, I think we're going to talk about Kelce a little bit more later. Raybon, you have any thoughts on that?
Yeah, I totally agree. I think that, you know, this is a year where you can get away with that tight end. But if any of the running backs that are normally in the first round happen to drop a David Johnson, even a Joe Mixon, I like getting that second back that I think can kind of be in the top six or have that top six upside as well. So those are the two guys that I look at.
Sean, you mentioned that your ability to draft guys in the second round is pretty much dependent on where you are slotted. And so that fits with our next question. If you can choose your draft position in a 12-man snake redraft league, which position do you want to draft in?
So that's a great question. Who asked that question, by the way? Because I love that question.
Mark McDonald.
Yeah, fantastic question. Now, I really don't care where I draft. I have a strategy from each spot. But if I were to choose one, I would say pick number four this year. The first round, you basically get whatever top four running back falls to you. I would be fine with any of them. And then, you know, in the second round, you can either get, you know, one of the top wide receivers that, you know, make it to you, or potentially Travis Kelce. Round three, you know, if you miss Travis Kelce, you can snag one of the top three tight ends or another wide receiver one. And then round four, you can get a second, you know, wide receiver one type guy or running back number two that falls to you. So I just think, you know, after the first four rounds, you're pretty much playing with house money. I think that's a pretty complete team. And you can make more aggressive picks later in the draft, because I think just having that fourth pick puts you in position to, like, you know, really snag the running backs, wide receivers, and tight ends that I'm looking for this year.
There was some fantastic swivel action going on with the chair, Sean, when you were answering that question. So I could tell that was one you were really excited about. Raybon, anything there?
I like pick eight because I actually think that the top eight running backs, there is not much, or my top eight running backs, there's not much, or as much of a difference as we think. And I like to be able to, so I want to be able to get close to that turn as possible to then be able to grab a guy on that back half who falls and then kind of do it again in rounds three and four. So I have, you know, Saquon, Zeke, McCaffrey, Kamara, but I also like, you know, Melvin Gordon, Le'Veon Bell, James Conner, and David Johnson just as much as those guys. So I'm fine anywhere up to pick eight, so I can get one of those eight.
All right, if you go wide receiver in the first two rounds, who is your must-have running back in the third round?
I'll say two, Damian Williams and Aaron Jones. Williams, because I think that he is going to have essentially the same role he had down the stretch last season. Kansas City always kind of tries to work in its backup just a little bit, whether it's in a pass catching role, like a Shark Kendrick West or a more traditional role like a Spencer Ware. They're always going to work in that guy like a Carlos Hyde, but I think Williams will be that lead guy, and he's proven effective. And then I think Aaron Jones kind of showed last year that he could do it all. He could be a feature back. And now with the new coaching staff, I think they are going to be mindful of not making the same mistakes that Mike McCarthy made, which was to kind of banish Jones to the bench for long stretches and not play him as much as they needed. So those are the two guys.
Sean, anything there?
No, I mean, if I had my way, I'm not taking my first running back in round three. As you know, that's sort of where the frozen pond begins. But I do like all these running backs in round three and round four. They're just all the same to me. So I'm more willing to kind of either grab the last tight end available or another, you know, you can get AJ Green, Keenan Allen type receivers in round three. So I might be, this is if I've taken two wide receivers, but I'd probably try to strategize my drafts where I'm not panicking trying to draft my first running back in round three. So, and I'm not one to kind of plan out in detail what positions I'm taking in rounds. I'm just going to take whatever guys fall to me. So I let the draft come to me. So, but you know, overall I'm, you know, kind of shying away from running backs in round three and four.
Yeah. Go ahead, Raybon.
Oh, sorry. I was just going to say, you know, going off what Sean said about not planning it out, I think that's important because I think you never know, you know, ADP is average draft position for a reason. Most ADP listings also come with the min and the max pick. I think you want to pay a lot more attention to that if you're really trying to craft a detailed plan, because a lot could change depending, you know, it's not just going to go according to the average. And I will say, if you are looking to kind of go round by round and plan things out, I would suggest a more helpful and effective strategy for doing so and really understanding the value in the draft is starting from the bottom, starting from the last pick and looking at the values you like the most at that pick and going the opposite way, because that'll show you, kind of give you that foresight as to what will be available later in the draft and what you feel comfortable with, and working your way backwards. I think that's always helped me a lot more than trying to start from round one, where it's kind of just a lot more cut and dry and you're not really gaining as much value from going over that.
Yeah, and just to kind of put a bow on this, I like Sean's idea of letting the draft kind of fall to you, taking the players who are falling. I mean, it's similar to like in sports betting, getting closing line value, where you're just taking the discounts that the market gives you wherever you can, as long as you're still doing it kind of within the confines of good team building, where you're not just taking, you know, like tight ends for five straight rounds or something like that. But exactly. Yeah, where it fits in with the constructs of your league. Kind of going off of that, there's a question here, I think a good question. Looking at the options that are available at different points in the draft, are there any instances where you're feeling like you should try to draft a certain number of players for a particular position by a given round? For example, thinking you should draft three running backs by the sixth round or something like that.
Absolutely not. Again, it kind of goes back to what we were saying. You don't want to pigeonhole yourself like that. So by letting the draft come to you, you know, you're going to kind of deviate from your original plan, which is totally fine. You're going to have to be able to sort of oddball the line. But, you know, after round six, I would be kind of scared if I only had like one running back. So running back's a position where I'm basically loading up early and often on it. So in general, I'm probably going to have two or three running backs by round six, but that's not something I'm planning necessarily.
Yeah, I agree. I think the only position I'd say it kind of dictates itself, because I think waiting on quarterback is, as we've talked about on the last episode, a really good strategy this year as it is most years. So yeah, I don't really want to have a quarterback before probably the double digit round. So that kind of dictates that I'm going to have, you know, nine rounds of flex eligible guys, probably at least one tight end. And I agree with Sean. I think there is a drop off in running back around that. After the frozen pond here, you know, that's even, if you still don't have two running backs, at least the guys that are going to fill your starting lineup, you probably want to be a little bit worried there. But aside from that, no, I think you have to let the draft come to you, as Sean said, because your league might just be, oh, we're going to take all running backs. And what if 30 straight running backs come off the board? I mean, you could get like Antonio Brown in the fifth round, which I'm sure Friedman would be thrilled with. and you have to take that. So I think that's the key, is just letting the draft come to you.
Don't worry, we are going to talk about Antonio Brown later, I am sure. Okay, next question from a Harvard grad with Harvard misspelled, which is really nice there. Given last season was so pass heavy, are you changing your strategy from overloading on running backs to snagging some wide receivers?
So, I mean, I wasn't confused that running back was a disaster last year. It's going to be a disaster this year too, but, you know, it's so valuable that that's why I plan accordingly. So, like I said, I'm drafting early and often running backs. I don't draft the kicker defense to add two more running backs. Usually, if you look at my teams, my entire bench is just a bunch of backup running backs. So you prepare for that, you know, Game of Thrones style of chaos during the season. Having said that, though, I do want to get, you know, at least one or possibly two wide receiver ones this year. They're just more stable, more consistent. You can rely on them the entire year. But, you know, when it comes to running backs in the draft, All the techniques I have, you know, they usually pan out around like week five or six when running backs start going down. So I do like to load up on more wide receivers to, you know, fill out my flex position early in the season. And then, you know, as running back, the turnover happens, you could start using them in your flex. So I think running back's a position that gains strength during the season. And that's why you saw teams in the championship round you know, starting guys like Jeff Wilson, Gus Edwards, CJ Anderson and stuff. So just planning accordingly, you have to take running back seriously during the draft and during the season. And then, you know, at the draft, you can only take wide receiver ones at the draft. That's not a position that you could pick up a wide receiver one during the season. So I absolutely believe in, you know, trying to get one or two top wide receivers early on.
All right.
Yeah,
go ahead, Raymond.
I just gonna say, you can't pay attention to league-wide passing trends in a vacuum, just because with the increase in passing comes the increase in passing to running back. So that it doesn't make sense to just say, oh, well, the league is passing more and therefore I'm going to take more receivers.
And it also makes the running backs that still have heavy workloads even more valuable.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. In the actual NFL, accumulating as many draft picks is a smart move, but does that translate to fantasy? Should I be looking to move back as much as possible? I'll just say, no, probably not.
I would say in the later rounds, a little bit more so, because I think that as you get past that, I would say, you know, there's about five or six rounds of players that, you know, at the flex eligible positions that you feel have a decently high floor, and then things start to go a little awry. And I'd say the ADP is not efficient enough. There is enough value later on that if I can kind of get some added value where I want it by trading back, you know, the difference between a ninth round pick or a 10th round pick or a 10th and a 12th is not different, because there's just so many guys that I feel that are even going, you know, undrafted in a lot of leagues that are going to provide starter value or near starter value that I don't have a problem moving back later on.
Yeah, I guess it's interesting. One of my preferred strategies, although it's harder to do, it really just kind of depends on the league that you're in, is actually trading up and kind of moving out of some of the middle rounds, because I find that I have like this barbell type of approach where mm-hmm. I like some of the guys who are kind of like the known entities. You can really project what they're going to do, and they're going in rounds 1 through 4. And then there are a lot of guys who are younger up-and-comers, maybe not known as much by people who are just in your average league. And those guys are available really late. So if I can kind of like bifurcate the way in which I'm approaching the pool of eligible players, that's one of the things I like to do. But it's hard to do that. It's hard to get trades actually done.
Yeah, agreed.
What is an outside-the-box strategy that may be a good strategy this year? Everyone waits on quarterback, zero RB. Everyone has heard those before. Is there something different this year?
I think for me, the most out-of-the-box thing, and this is not totally out-of-the-box, but I mean, again, I don't think you should be planning around positions. I don't think you should be planning drafts from the top down. But for the purpose of answering the question, I think an interesting one is waiting on wide receiver. I guess some would call it zero wide receiver, because I do see a lot of receivers in those middle to late rounds that I think could return top, you know, 12, top 24 value. And so, and I think that their ADPs aren't very efficient, at least at this point in the offseason. So I think, you know, grabbing a stud running back, maybe grabbing even two of the tight ends, because if you can get like a Kelce and a Ertz or a Kittle, that's a pretty out of the box thing. And those guys are putting up wide receiver one numbers anyway. So it's not like you're necessarily losing out on the numbers that you would have gotten from drafting a wide receiver there, but you're going to dominate that position. You're going to take away somebody else from dominating it. And you can also still be building your running back stable up, because as Sean mentioned, you know, those guys are going to be valuable. Quarterback is always going to be there. So you still don't have to take a quarterback early, but I think that would be the most quote-unquote out-of-the-box strategy that I would probably employ.
At the risk of derailing us, I'm going to ask you a question here, which is kind of about strategy. What are your thoughts on really going after rookies in regular redraft leagues, especially, let's say, like kind of fishier redraft leagues? Like, so the strategy, the theory behind it is that you might have a whole bunch of guys playing who don't know who a lot of the rookies are. And so those rookies might, just because they don't have the name value yet, they might fall down the board in these kind of fishier drafts and provide more value.
I think that kind of goes back to with my letting the draft come to me. You know, I'm going to grade out all the rookies accordingly. And, you know, if they happen to fall where I think there's a value, I'm going to take them. But, you know, I definitely wouldn't reach anticipating my league to pass up on him. I'd kind of let the league pass up on him and then scoop him up. So, but I know what you're saying. I'm in some leagues where, you know, I love them to death, but they don't know what they're doing, and it's an offline draft and they're using magazines and stuff. So yeah, leagues like that, you know, I'm getting ridiculous guys late. Yeah. So yeah, like a N'Keal Harry will, you know, fall to the 15th round or something. So yeah, I think that's another important point, you know, knowing your league mates. And, you know, knowing their tendencies is a huge edge going into the draft. I think that's something that's pretty overlooked.
Yeah, I think I'll just add that in general, rookie running backs that are slotted to be starters tend to be pretty safe. Running backs tend to peak a little bit earlier, and they tend to be given large work. If they're in a position to get large workloads, that tends to come to fruition more often than not because there's not a huge learning curve. With wide receivers, I'd be a little bit more conservative just because there is a greater learning curve. I think my favorite time to take rookie wide receivers is kind of late in the draft, as Friedman was alluding to, you know, when you could kind of get those guys for free. They might have even gone undrafted, and you don't have to rely on them for any type of starter or even wide receiver four production. Those are my favorite times. But I'd say if you're still feeling a little bit confused about this, I would suggest just going on like a Pro Football Reference player season finder. And what you can do is you can filter by round and just look at the last 5 or 10 years and sort by targets and just see for the amount of draft capital teams spend on a receiver or any position, how much of a workload did they get? And you can kind of see what's kind of a median to range to expect, range of outcomes to expect.
All right. Where are you at with Fournette?
I think that, you know, it's a little concerning just the kind of beef he's had with Tom Coughlin and the organization. But I think that's probably as much of the fault of Tom Coughlin and the organization. I think that one thing that Jacksonville did show is when they still were kind of in contention, they were willing to use Fournette really heavily in both the run and the pass game and around the goal line. So I think that he's just one of those. I would probably say, I don't know how you feel about this, Sean, but I would probably say he is in the frozen pond tier, but one of the highest upside guys in that tier.
He's definitely walking on top of the ice. Like he's like the cutoff, I think. Because I would love to get him if he falls around 3. I think all these factors that you brought up are great. And, you know, he's had a riddled injury history, you know, yes, going back to college. So I think that's kind of suppressing his value, but that upside's there, so if he falls around 3, I actually like him there. But, you know, having said that, I'm pretty in line with his ADP being, you know, the 13th or 14th running back. But, you know, that's his role to have if he can stay healthy. So that's why I think he's just above the frozen pond tier. I don't think he meets the criteria typically used to describe those types of guys.
Like, I'll put it this way. When you think about – I mean, I don't know how you guys feel, but – if I'm thinking about a top 3 running back, like a top 3 finish, you know, per game, I don't rule Leonard Fournette out of that. Like Leonard Fournette in the right this year, if the touchdowns are there and he's used like he was last year, and you know, he could be a top 3. So I wouldn't pass up on him just because of what happened last year. I think there's some concerns that you don't necessarily want to put him in that same tier as the guys in the first and early second.
Sean, is Derrick Henry in the frozen pond tier?
He's definitely in that range, but he's one of the guys that I would say doesn't meet the criteria either. You know, last year wasn't a fluke by any means. You know, it was about this time last year I was like in a depressed state that the Titans brought in Deion Lewis because I was ready to load up on Derrick Henry. And lo and behold, like, you know, Deion Lewis doesn't get hurt and Henry ends up just erupting at the end of the year. So I think the Titans will sort of go into the season knowing they need to use Henry like they did at the end of last year. Having said that, though, you know, when it comes to any sort of PPR format, he might be a little overrated. But if you're in a standard format, getting him in, you know, the 4th or 5th round, I say go for it. You know, typically the criteria of a frozen pond guy is, you know, they kind of had a fluky end of the season. I hate to say it, but, you know, a guy like Damian Williams might be that kind of guy. But, you know, I still like him because of the offense. Or other guys that fit my frozen pond criteria, guys that, you know, they're sort of the nominal starter to start the year, but they have guys behind them that can take over by like week 3. And now you just have a guy you have to drop. I don't think Derrick Henry is either of those guys. So I think he's pretty safe in that RB2 range and would not consider him part of the frozen pond here.
I think the one thing that's interesting to think about is that the Titans will now have their 5th play caller in 5 years. Arthur Smith, tight ends coach, was promoted. An interesting kind of subplot to that is that he's the tight ends coach. However, the Titans were kind of chided for running, I think, the most archaic offense in the league last year. They had the most 2 tight end personnel, I believe. And I think, you know, teams generally hear these whispers, and I wonder – you know, they seem in their draft, you know, they got Brown. And so I think that you will see, in, especially with Delanie Walker and Jonnu Smith now coming off injury, you know, you could be down to Mykole Pruitt and Firkser as your top 2 for a large part of camp. And so I think that they will be running more 3 wide sets. I think that will affect Henry in a certain type of way. So I am a little bit kind of concerned just because, you know, the guy who was essentially responsible for playing him and riding him down the street. Yes, the, you know, the head coach is still there, but, you know, there's a new OC. So, I think there is a little bit of concern just in that sense. But I think that he has that upside that if he is that guy, I mean, he could go nuts. So I think that Vrabel, you know, thinking about his time in New England, might look at Henry as like a LeGarrette Blount type of guy who, you know, if the team is winning and they're able to kind of stay in games like they were last year, he's going to be really good. But if for some reason the bottom falls out and this is the year the Titans finally kind of stop overachieving because they've won, I think, 9 games for what, 3 straight years? If they stop overachieving, yeah. You could be in for that kind of early season disappointment with Henry again. So he's a guy like I'd probably rather have Fournette. I don't know. I'm kind of going back and forth on it in my rankings.
All right. How do you see the 49ers backfield shaking out? Is Tevin Coleman the guy to roster?
Ooh, I think they're ranked accordingly right now. You know, in a vacuum, I would obviously like to take Coleman, but, you know, that's pretty baked into his ADP right now. They're really hard to sort out. So in situations like that, I typically get the guy being underdrafted, and that would be Breida. I would just stash him later in the draft. And, you know, if Coleman misses time or they trade away or cut McKinnon, now you have Breida, who showed last year he can take on a big role. And, you know, despite not being able to stay healthy last year, I think he'd be the guy that I think is posing the most value to just benefit from this crowded backfield. So, I mean, in general, I'm avoiding it altogether.
Yeah, I think you have to be careful to label it and think of it in that way as like a guy to own in the San Fran backfield. I think there are certain coaches, and many of them now are realizing that, especially, you know, with what New England's been doing. And, you know, I think even what the Rams did with Gurley and Anderson, you know, increased the visibility, the hyper-visibility of it, of having these committees. So I think, you know, from what I've heard and the quotes I've seen from Shanahan, he said that he envisions Coleman as kind of his big back. So I'm thinking that he envisions Coleman as kind of what Alfred Morris would have brought to the table last year, even though that's probably not exactly what we think of Coleman as. We think of him as still a speed guy, but I think Coleman's going to fill was brought in to fill a particular type of role, that kind of big back goal line type of guy. And I think then McKinnon is kind of looked at as, you know, Breida insurance and vice versa. I don't think they're sure about McKinnon yet, but I think that Breida and McKinnon will have a similar type of role. And if McKinnon is not healthy, I think that really increases the viability of Breida. But right now I have Coleman at 40% of the carries, Breida at 30%, McKinnon at 18%, and Raheem Mostert at 9%, and Juszczyk at about 2%. I think Mostert might still factor in because Shanahan does like him a lot. So that'll be interesting to see as well.
Who are the running backs going around round 5 who are potential lead backs?
Well, it depends on your draft. I think, you know, certain drafts where maybe a Jacobs falls that low, I don't think he should. Lamar Miller is another guy who, it's from all indications, it seems like the Texans are going to go forward with him again. And he's been getting about 2/3 of the carries and about 7-8% of the targets. So, you know, not spectacular, but I think, you know, you have Deshaun Watson and a modestly improved O-line and the receivers back healthy. I think that's still a potentially explosive offense. And so he's kind of the guy I've been snagging if I need an extra running back at that point in the draft.
Yeah, I think, you know, there's a ton after round 5, and that's essentially what you're trying to do, is get guys that can, you know, elevate to that role. You know, some of the backups where if the starter gets hurt are pretty easy to gauge, but, you know, round 5, guys that don't really require somebody to get hurt that could take over are guys like, you know, David Montgomery on Chicago. Lamar Miller, like Raybon said, is pretty much already in that role. Mark Ingram, Miles Sanders for Philly, Ronald Jones in Tampa. You know, a lot of these guys, you know, if they, you know, break out this season, could take over. But then you have guys like Latavius Murray that have value already to start the season. But if Kamara gets hurt, would sort of take over that role. And, you know, he would be a round 3 or round 2 kind of value at that point. But you definitely don't want to start trying to predict injuries, you know, in the round 5 to 10 range. You're just trying to get these guys that just talent alone can elevate them to a workhorse role. So there's a few of them around that range.
Oh my God. Yeah. And I just want to, like, Mark Ingram, man, like, I was down on him last year, so you know, I ain't biased. I love Mark Ingram this year. Like, if he's still around in a 5th round, I mean, look at what the Ravens are doing. They have a quarterback that might not attempt more than like 25 to 28 passes per game. They had an effective run game with Gus Edwards, who was like the third or fourth guy. I understand that every year we draft the wrong Baltimore running back and it changes by midseason. Yeah. But I think you have to look at it like this. They had an effective run game already with the guys on the roster that were cheap, and they still felt it necessary to bring in a Mark Ingram. And so with the way this team operates now, I do think that the defense will take a step back, but this is going to be an extremely run-heavy team. They're going to need more than one back, and I think Omar Moyo is going to be that lead back. And just given his skill set, I mean, he's obviously more talented than Edwards, than Alex Collins. He could have a monster year.
Yeah, he's actually falling to like round 6 and 7.
Ooh, oh, snag him. Yeah. Pick him up.
Ito Smith, is he worth drafting inside of round 10?
No. Next question.
Okay. Have been in a dilemma, Andrew Luck or Mahomes in second round of the draft. Whom do you prefer this year? I would say neither in the second round of the draft. Do either of you disagree with me?
No, but definitely not Andrew Luck in the second round.
No, just wait. Just wait. Yeah. There's the top 12 quarterbacks, and the quarterbacks 13 to 24 could conceivably finish as the top 12, and the top 12 is the 13 to 24 outside of maybe like Mahomes, Mayfield, you know, and Luck. So, wait.
What is the earliest you think it's okay to draft a quarterback?
Round 3? I wouldn't be one of those people, but I think round 3 is the time.
Okay, well, let's say you personally. Let's say Patrick Mahomes is there in round 4. Do you draft him?
It depends how the first 3 rounds went, but I would definitely have to consider it.
Round 5? If he's there
Round 5 for sure. Yeah, okay. Depending on league settings, if they're weird. Yeah. But, yeah, just straight up league, round 5 for sure.
Yeah. Raybon?
This is going to sound way too contrarian, but I would say round 7 because I would want 2 running backs, 3 wide receivers, and either a flex or a tight end before I touch the quarterback.
Yeah. Okay. How do you project quarterback run totals for likely outlier schemes such as Baltimore or Buffalo?
I love this question, so yeah. I hope we can spend some time on it, because I'm guessing we'll all have quite slightly different methods of this.
By the way, this question was asked by Josh ADHD at Fantasy HD, ADHD. Shout out to Josh, great guy.
Word, please follow him on Twitter. Awesome, awesome content. So yeah, I think that for me personally, what I use is for every team, you're gonna have base rates, and for every stat, you're gonna have base rates, and then you're gonna have a stabilization point, which is essentially when the R squared is 0.5, you know, when it's half skill, half luck. And so for me, what I use is I look at rushing attempts for quarterbacks as a quarterback trait as part of the overall projection for him. So I start, you know, I project rushing attempts as a function of dropbacks and of pass attempts. So depending on how many, for every, you know, dropback, you know, even if it's a designed run, that's still going to impact the team. And so you can't project, let's say, Baltimore with Lamar Jackson, they're running, you know, 35, 40 times a game. Well, you can't just say, oh, well, Baltimore is going to run 35, 40 times a game. And then let's say you had Joe Flacco come back in and you just have a completely wrong projection of rushing attempts for the team. So I start with quarterback with their dropbacks, and then I project rushing attempts as a function of that, and then I'm projecting overall play volume based on how many games I think a team's going to win in game script, and then whatever is left over after I have pass attempts, sacks, and quarterback rushes, that gets allocated to the rest of the rushing attempts for the running backs, receivers, and whoever else might attempt the Taysom Hills, you know, those guys.
Yeah, so I do a lot of the similar techniques that Raybon mentioned. I consider rush attempts more of a skill-based and scheme-based stat, so that's going to be a little more stable year to year. Yards per rush and touchdown percentage, I regress those a lot more. Having said that, you know, Josh Allen and Lamar Jackson, they were pretty crazy last year, and I do expect them to regress a little bit in the rush attempts, but not too much. Josh Allen especially, you know, I went back and watched a lot of his run attempts, and you know, they have a weird offense where, you know, they send everyone deep, and if they're covered, Josh Allen will just pull down and run. And, you know, dude's a freak. He's a great runner. So I don't really see that changing much. I do think bringing in Cole Beasley, they might be saying, hey, you know, if they're, you know, cover deep, check it down to Cole Beasley. And that could sort of lower his attempts still. But I'm keeping him roughly the same. But his yards per rush last year, 7.1, that's going to come down. So have that, you know, closer to a normal 5.5 for someone his caliber. And then his rush touchdowns will come down a little bit. So, you know, I'm regressing Allen quite a bit in the running department, but I think he'll make up for it in the passing game. I think they brought in some weapons. So, you know, I'm giving a boost in the passing game. Lamar Jackson, on the other hand, you know, he was averaging 17 rushing attempts a game in his starts last year, and I have it closer to 12. I just think it's not really sustainable to have a guy like that take a beating at quarterback in addition to sacks. So I'm thinking, you know, they'll bring it down to closer to 12, and they're going to have less positive game scripts in general. You know, the defense is going to take a step back, so he's going to have to throw more. Having said that, you know, I think his yards per attempt will actually go up this year. I think he'll have more efficient run and design runs and things like that. So, and his touchdown rate was pretty stable. So having said all that, he's coming in as my QB9, and that's, you know, giving quite a bit of regression in the running department. So that's why I've been targeting him, you know, as my QB2 in a lot of drafts, because I'm factoring a ton of regression and he's still, you know, a QB1 for me. So a lot of the skill-based things are still going to be there this year. So anything else is upside. So, you know, when I approach these rushing stats, I'm, you know, sort of balancing the skill and luck and just letting the chips fall where they may.
Yeah, I will say, I have Lamar at 12.9 carries. I have Josh Allen at 7.3. And I do agree. I think there's a lot more variance that I give in terms of my range of outcomes for projecting quarterback yard per carry than there is with running back, where they're almost all exactly the same, because it takes about 2,000 carries for a running back's yard per carry number to actually stabilize. So a lot of that variance we're seeing is just, it's not really predictive at all.
All right. Here's a question. What is the best experience you've ever had in your life? For me, the answer is booking an experience through Airbnb Experiences. Nailed it. On last week's show, I talked about hiking with my wife, which we booked through Airbnb Experiences. We had a professional naturalist guiding us through the wild woodlands near the Iowa River. That was definitely a great experience. And I imagine one that is just representative of how awesome the total suite of available Airbnb experiences truly is. You know about Airbnb. It is your go-to site if you're looking for a place to stay. But you should check out the site for Airbnb experiences, which provide access to activities that you can't easily find elsewhere. Airbnb experiences are designed for active participation, so you can do something new. They are curated for quality and vetted for safety. These aren't your typical tours and activities. Airbnb experiences are hosted by locals who have deep expertise in their field. These are real experts with long-time hands-on experience who are guiding you through your own experience. With these experiences, you learn things you can't find online or in a textbook, and most importantly, you have fun. There are Airbnb experiences in over 1,000 cities around the world, so there are lots of options for you to choose from. You don't need to be traveling to try Airbnb experiences. You can do them right in your hometown, which is exactly what I did for my experience. For your own adventures, check out airbnb.com/experiences to explore one-of-a-kind activities created for the curious. Okay, guys, if we're going to get through the rest of the questions, we are really going to have to pick up the pace. So no long-windedness, if possible. Next question, are you going to do another of your three major tendencies of offensive defensive coordinators coaches article?
Yes, I'm going to bring it back. There's a lot of interest in it, and I think I can really lend a voice in terms of I've been studying not just the coordinators and the tendencies, but just organizational philosophy that goes past it, that goes to the GM and the owner. And a lot of times those guys are issuing orders and putting these coordinators under mandates. So it's not just as simple as saying, oh, hey, this guy threw to the tight end 18% of the time, and so that's what I'm going to kind of project. It goes a lot deeper than that. So I am going to bring that back, whether that's one article or just, you know, the three bullet points within each of our team previews. It'll be there in some form.
Does Doug Peterson like to use a backfill committee because he doesn't have good backs, or does he do it because he has good backs, but he just likes to use a committee?
I'll jump on that one. So I think, so from what we've seen, he wants two backs, usually a more complete element that can catch passes, but also a power element. We've seen him kind of use Jamal Charles and Nile Davis in those roles. Then in Philly, they had Ryan Matthews, Darren Sproles. So I think two is he kind of wants to use. I think they don't necessarily want to do the three like Philly was doing for a while. I think that was more of a function of having Sproles in the mix and not really having a lot of proven guys outside of that. So I think they'll kind of settle on Sanders and Howard this year.
Should I be overly worried that the Saints lost their center?
No, they brought in Nick Eason from Minnesota to hopefully fill in the gap that Unger created when he retired. And they also drafted Eric McCoy. So if, you know, Easton doesn't work out, they could plug in the rookie who's considered to be a high floor prospect. So, you know, it's not something that I'm really factoring in too much in Kamara, Breeze, or MT. I think you just draft those guys straight up. It's not something I'd be overly concerned about.
Okay. But how should I gauge the Arizona offensive line? How much better will they be based on health, improved health? And then does the air raid scheme mean that even if the offensive line players aren't that good, the offensive line as a whole will be better?
I think that's a great question. Number one, yeah, offensive line play does not carry over from year to year, does not correlate that much. So you kind of have to assume that teams are going to regress, that the worst are going to regress a little bit. I think, yes, Humphreys and Pugh being healthy will help. I think adding Marcus Gilbert will help. So I think they'll be modestly better, maybe below average, maybe around league average. And I do think that the air raid scheme helps, because what that will do is they'll spread it out a little more, 3-4 wide receivers. Johnson will have, or whoever's the back, will have more room to work. And you also have to remember that a quarterback that's mobile like a Kyler Murray usually gives a little bump to running backs in terms of efficiency, because defenses have to account for that quarterback and kind of account on the edge for which one they're going to follow, the quarterback or the runner back on certain type of option plays.
Yeah, and Evan Silva pointed this out on Twitter a couple of days ago. Cliff Kingsbury had a very good system at Texas Tech in terms of offensive line play, a very low sack rate in general, in part because there was such an emphasis on getting the ball out quickly from the quarterback. So as we've seen with the Rams over the past couple of years, even if the offensive line isn't all that great, it can look much, much better just based on how the quarterback is deployed. Would Friedman trade Antonio Brown for Kyler Murray straight up in Dynasty? This is a great question, and I could talk about it for hours. Instead, I will talk about it for just minutes. No, I don't believe that I actually would, because I would hope that I could get more for Antonio Brown than just Kyler Murray. But if I were focused on this year, I think Antonio Brown probably provides more utility this year. So if I were really focused on winning this year, I would want Antonio Brown. If I'm thinking more long-term, I think this really might be the last year of like high-end utility out of Antonio Brown. So even from that perspective, I think now would be a good time to try to trade him for an asset. I would just hope to be able to get more than Kyler Murray. And I think starting in year two, so we'll say 2020, I think Kyler Murray would be able to give more than Antonio Brown. Like I have a really high opinion of Kyler Murray. I think he's a league winning type of player. So he is someone I would want. If I could trade Antonio Brown for Kyler Murray plus something else, I would definitely do it. Did you guys play any sports in high school or college?
Yep. High school, 4 years varsity, cross country, team captain for one of them, and baseball all 4 years, 2.5 on varsity. I was a pitcher and outfielder, extreme contact, no power hitter with base running smarts. And I would try to pull a lot of trick plays, hidden ball tricks, game theory type thing. So pretty par for the course with me.
Yeah, no, I didn't play any. Our football team actually got there was like a really bad injury, I guess, and our football team got taken away. So that's what I wanted to play. I would have been one of those like real quick returner types, but you know, didn't do that. So played some sports that aren't actually sports after school in high school, if you know what I mean.
Yeah, I did basketball. You know, JV superstar. Our team went undefeated. We were so fantastic. And then baseball for 4 years, outfielder. I had such a weak arm. It was an embarrassment. So eventually I started as a center fielder on varsity freshman year, because I was fast, but my arm was so weak, eventually I just had to move me to left field, which saved my arm. Okay. what the hell kind of season is Antonio Brown going to have in your opinion? I'll just say, in my opinion, I think he will probably be a low-end wide receiver one. And I think that's probably I think that's realistic. I think that's also kind of close to his ceiling. And I think in part, it's just he's going to be fed a lot of volume. But I think there's also a lot of potential for downside here, especially mm-hmm. if things start to go sideways with the offense. And, you know, we'll see how he really likes playing with someone who is not a future Hall of Famer in a city where people aren't going to care as much about the team. Anyway, what do you guys think?
Yeah, I agree with that completely. You know, the targets are going to be there, so I definitely you should draft him as a wide receiver one. But you know, there's a lot of hidden downside there. Like you mentioned, you know, just imagine the Raiders are 4-10 heading into the fantasy playoffs. Antonio Brown is known to be sort of an off-field problem. Who knows what's going to be going on, you know, and that's, I don't plan for those scenarios, but that's got to be at least like a 10% chance where he and Derek Carr are feuding heading into the fantasy playoffs. And you're wondering if you could even start him. But other red flags with him are, you know, we've seen whenever Big Ben went down and he had to play with the backup quarterback, he's typically a wide receiver two, even wide receiver three in those spots. And the elite guys like Devontae Adams, DeAndre Hopkins, whenever the quarterback goes down, it doesn't matter who's QB, Tom Savage, Brett Hundley, those guys are still elite wide receiver ones. And he's never really shown that in the past because I think, you know, with him, a lot of it had to do with the chemistry between him and Big Ben. So I'm just wondering if he'll be able to get that with Derek Carr so quickly at, you know, age 31. So there's a lot of red flags there, but, you know, he's still going to see a ton of targets. So you can't ignore him completely.
Yeah, I think the one downside I'm really concerned about is that there were times, especially last year, where Amari Cooper was open and Derek Carr didn't throw him the ball and Derek Carr kind of took the check down. So that to me is the downside. But yeah, I still have him. I have him ranked eighth in half point PPR. I still think that the target share will be in that 26 to 30% range.
Who are the wide receivers you like for consistency over ceiling? So the guys who aren't league winners, but you can play them every week and bank on 12-plus PPR points.
I love this question. I think the guy that basically embodies this question is Golden Tate. He's being drafted around like wide receiver 35 and 40 in PPR. So I've been getting him as, you know, a late-round flex. You know, I wouldn't want him to be my wide receiver two or three necessarily, but you can get him late enough where he's your flex to start the year. I have him at exactly 12 PPR points per game average. So I think he's one of those safe guys that's just going to give you a consistent high floor, not necessarily much upside, but just a guy you can just trust to plug in and get you 12 or so points every week.
Yeah, I think that's a good one. I think Tyler Boyd, Larry Fitzgerald, guys who might not have that league winning upside anymore. I think even Sterling Shepard, you know, opposite Golden Tate, is going to be a pretty high volume guy. I think a guy I've talked about him before, but Curtis Samuel is a guy who I think is going to get a lot of looks each game. You know, we've seen them give him 5, 6, 7 touches combined in a run pass game when he's only played 20-30% of the snap. So he might actually have a little more upside, but I think he's going to have a pretty safe floor as well. And as is Christian Kirk, but I actually think he has a lot more upside. But I think he'll get schemed easy completions every game as well.
All right, Tyreek Hill. We have questions on his situation, a few of them. So we're going to kind of wrap those all into one question. How are you looking at Tyreek Hill? And how does that impact the way you are evaluating Sammy Watkins and also Travis Kelce?
I think right now I'm assuming Tyreek Hill's not going to play this year. That might be dangerous, but I think it's just you have to pick a side right now. So having said that, I've mentioned it before, I'm targeting Kelce early and often. But also I mentioned on our last pod, Sammy Watkins is still going around wide receiver 24, and I think you got to get that if you're doing best balls right now. Once Tyreek is announced out for the season, I think he'll rise closer to the top 15. I'm not sure yet, but I think he'll definitely be a top 20 ADP by then. And, you know, last year he was wide receiver 24 in the 9 games he was healthy. So you're kind of just getting that built-in upside as potentially being the number one wide receiver for Patrick Mahomes. So I think you got to do it at wide receiver 24.
Yeah, I think the biggest concern with Watkins is not production. It's just staying healthy. I think right. You know, he's still one of the bigger injury risks at the position. But in terms of upside, I think he has as much as any. Like, I think it's not out of the question for Sammy Watkins, assuming Tyreek Hill is out, to finish as the overall wide receiver one. Go ahead.
Oh, no, I was just going to finish up my you know, with him, you know, he's been around the league, seems like forever, been on so many teams. You just assume he's like 3 years old. He's still, you know, only 26 entering his prime. So I think that, you know, You're right with the injury concerns, but, you know, he does have age on his side. So you have to keep in mind that he's younger than people think.
Oh yeah, absolutely. Like he has the top overall upside. I'm just treating Hill the same way as Sean. I'm assuming he's not going to play. And I have Mecole Hardman kind of slotted into Tyreek Hill at 83 targets as a rookie. So that's about five per game. That's tentatively what I have Hardman at right now. So even if I had to plug Hill back into that, let's say he was suspended for 8 games or something like that, but they kept him, it would kind of work out to a similar amount of targets. So I'm not really too worried about it. I think Watkins and Kelce are the big winners here.
Sean, shooting from the hip, if you had to handicap the odds of Tyreek Hill playing a game this season, what would that be? I think he plays.
Really? Okay. So you think it's over 50% then?
I mean, that's a fiery, very optimistic take. But, yeah, I mean, the longer this goes without anything happening, the more realistic I think it is that he plays.
Yeah, I haven't been as much online sleuth as I was with LeSean McCoy last year, so I can't put a good – this might be a good, like, Twitter poll. I think this is something you'd want to just get a wisdom of the crowds type of poll on it, because it's hard to gauge. Like you said, you know, the longer this goes on, you have to wonder if they're just going to just roll with him. So it's definitely worth monitoring, especially this time of year if you're doing best balls.
All right, there are a lot of questions that have to do with Kelce, Ertz, and Kittle, and then whether anyone else can sort of like break into the top tier or who you're targeting after that. So I kind of want to lump this all into one question of like, what are you doing with your tight ends, or like, what is your tight end drafting philosophy?
So I'll go first because I've been pretty clear. I'm trying to get one of the top three, especially Kelce early on. The part of this question that I do want to hit on, which I think is really cool, is who will be the Eric Ebron of this year? I think that's a great question because I would say Vance McDonald sort of hits all the boxes that Ebron had last year.
Yeah.
You have a guy that's talented. He's on a top offense. And, you know, part of Ebron's success last year was Jack Doyle went down. There wasn't really many receivers behind T.Y. Hilton that were doing anything. And then T.Y. Hilton himself was banged up. So I think Vance McDonald hits all those boxes. There's no more A.B. There's no more Jesse James to even, you know, consider someone taking tight end targets away. So I think he is the guy, you know, he's sort of – I forgot where Ebron was being drafted last year, but he's lurking. McDonald is lurking around like tight end 12 to 14. So he just strikes me as a guy that could be a top five tight end easily this year, sort of upside. So he sort of reminds me of Ebron going into last year.
Yeah, I like that. Raybon, what do you think?
Yeah, I like that because I think Juju now is going to get more coverage too. You got to remember that. And another one I think, and I've talked about this, is David Njoku, because I think Baker Mayfield is going to be so good, and you're going to have to pay attention to Beckham. You're going to have to pay attention to Landry, that it's possible Njoku is that kind of third priority for the defense, which lends itself well to him getting an outlier amount of touchdowns because his quarterback is so good and he's going to throw them to somebody. And he has that athletic ability as well to kind of be – to kind of be that guy. So I like those two guys.
Yeah. And for me, one guy, I mean, very different in terms of the dynamic of Eric Ebron, but one guy who I think has potential as a late round tight end, and we talked about him previous show, Mark Andrews. I think a lot of potential there in Baltimore. He has an established connection with Lamar Jackson. Okay. I wish kickers could have their points as part of the defense. So for instance, the Lions defense would get Prater's points. What are your thoughts on this?
I get it, but I don't really like that any more than just having them separate, because I think they are two totally different positions. And I don't think you want to, if you're drafting defenses, you want to be able to at least think of defenses as defense and as, you know, maybe incorporating a little bit of that return game. But adding kickers just adds like a whole nother layer that I think overcomplicates it. I think if anything, you want to simplify it and just, you know, eliminate the position completely if you don't like it.
Yeah. Okay. Fab tips and tricks or general strategies.
So I mean, there's, you kind of have to just let that come to you also, but I've typically, just like hoarded my budget and save it for, you know, two big buys during the year, typically running backs. And I think one of the things you want to avoid is just getting guys that, you know, just had a big game, but they don't really have a role, going forward that would, you know, draw a big bid. So I'm also factoring in, you know, if a star running back gets suspended for a game or two or goes down, I'm not going to load up on a guy just for a two-game rental. If a guy's ruled out for a year, a starting running back, I'm willing to load up and just, you know, go all in on the backup running back or somebody that I think is going to provide me the value for the rest of the season. So having said that, I usually just make two huge bids a year. Other times, you know, I punt on kicker and defense at the draft. So I'm usually just doing $1 kicker defense buys here and there, just getting the team I like the most. But I just urge people to fall away from the traps of just, you know, spending $30 on a guy that, you know, is just going to fizzle away in a couple weeks.
Okay, next question here. Auction strategy, 12-team PPR. I mean, there are a lot of details in this question. So instead of going through that, I just kind of want your general auction strategy.
So some of the tips that I have for auction drafts, which I take part in every year, I love them. It's pretty obvious. You want to get guys at value. You're going to have dollar values, and you want to save money and get guys cheaper than you have on your dollar values. That's great and all, but when you enter in the draft, I think right away, right off the bat, you need to be a little bit aggressive because everybody is, and there's sort of an inflation in the draft because of that. So don't be afraid to overbid early. Definitely go over your dollar values by a few bucks to snag some of these top receivers, top running backs. It's okay because no one's going to have money later in the draft. So you're going to still be able to get, you know, great value later in the drafts. Another tip I have is every pick, every nomination, try to bid, you know, 70%, 75% of your dollar value. And you just try to get people off guard. You know, sometimes if it's an offline draft, you know, people are going to grab pizza or beer or whatever. And there's just some league-wide brain farts where a guy goes way too cheap. So if you're constantly just bidding, you know, certain up to a certain point, you can snag those guys that you didn't even expect to get cheap. And another really good tip I can give for auctions, it's sort of reverse of snake drafts. Snake drafts, I always urge to get guys at the end of a tier because there's going to be a big drop off. When it comes to auction drafts, I actually urge to get a guy at the top of a tier. Usually the league kind of is in agreement with tiers in general. And when there's one guy left in a tier, those are the guys that usually get overbid. So that's why at the beginning of the draft, people usually just pass up on a guy like DeAndre Hopkins because they know they can get, they have their pick of Devontae Adams, Michael Thomas, those guys. So the first guy nominated is usually the best value. So you want to avoid being part of those guys that are panicking and trying to get to the last guy in the tier and, you know, you end up overbidding. So I think those general tips I think I've learned over the years are great ways to kind of dominate your auction draft.
Okay, we have a question about keepers. 10-team league, do I keep Barkley in the first, Christian McCaffrey in the second, Adam Thielen in the ninth, or Chubb in the 15th? I think I'd say pretty clearly Chubb in the 15th, but I might be wrong here.
I agree.
Yeah, I mean, it's. I would say they're all good. Maybe Thielen in the ninth is probably the one you just wouldn't consider. Yeah. You can make a case for all three running backs. Chubb in the 15th is just crazy to me.
Yeah. Similar one here. Kittle in round 19 or Chubb in round 16?
Kittle.
Yeah, I agree with that.
Kittle.
Yeah. What picks would you need to get in return to trade your first round pick in a standard redraft?
Maybe two early seconds, I guess. I don't play in a ton of leagues where we're like trading picks all crazy. So this might be one better for you. But I would think if I'm trading out of the first round, I definitely want to kind of be able to get that advantage of you know, getting that extra pick early on somewhere in that second round.
Yeah, I agree with that. And then I would want to get some picks back later, maybe in the middle of the draft where I feel like I'm still able to find value. And I would say, like, I kind of would think to earmark this as like, oh, this is my pick for a specific like player or a specific position. Because like, if I have to sacrifice, it's like I'm sacrificing for something in particular that I feel pretty strongly will be within this draft range and will make a difference for my team. But yeah, in general, I kind of don't like to trade out of the first round. Okay, final question here. Who is the one player? We teased this before. It's all coming back together. Who is the one player you expect to surprise everybody and be this year's fantasy draft darling, either like Philip Lindsay or Patrick Mahomes as the example here? Mahomes, I think, is a little bit different because people could kind of see that coming. But Philip Lindsay truly came out of nowhere.
Yeah, I mean, I think some people will know this guy if you play like a lot of Dynasty, but like more so, you know, the average redraft player might not be as familiar, but we talked about him before, Andy Isabella of the Cardinals. I think he has a chance to, if things go all the way right for him, I mean, he could even lead that team in reception. So I think Kirk will be that guy, but I think that the way they spread the ball around, and if you look at his production in college, I mean, he was just tremendously productive, high volume guy. I think that it's possible that in that kind of simplified offense, I think that he could be a big, big factor in year one because he adds a dimension that I don't think Larry Fitzgerald really has at this point in terms of being able to separate, and he could slot in right alongside Kirk as those two, as that main guy in that offense.
So, I mean, like Lindsey was just, you know, that's rare. That's probably not going to happen for another decade. So it's hard to establish what criteria that would be. But I'm going to get pretty meta with this and say Royce Freeman will be that guy this year. He'll take his job back from Philip Lindsey. Nice. I do like Philip Lindsey. I think, you know, last year wasn't a fluke by any means. It's just, that's just the way running back committees work out, where just one guy can run away with it. But he did, you know, he fizzled out towards the end of last year. He's no lock to be that guy again this year. So I think Royce Freeman, I mean, he looked good last year. It was just kind of unfortunate that Lindsey was so good. So he's a guy that, you know, if something happens to Lindsey or Freeman breaks out next year, he could push RB1 potential as a workhorse running back. You know, having said that, this is an outlier I'm trying to carve out. But, you know, in that sort of scenario, he would kind of fit that Lindsey mold of someone we were kind of overlooking altogether, but could be a guy that you can get really late and be, you know, potential RB2, RB1 value.
Yeah. I like that Andy Isabella call. What would keep me away from him in this scenario is that he is a second rounder. So, I mean, I think it would be maybe, I don't know, like both almost like too easy to project him being awesome, but then also like, oh, he's a wide receiver. It's hard for those first year wide receivers to fully break out. So I'm going to go with two rookie running backs. One is Justice Hill. Fourth rounder, has great size adjusted athleticism, great speed, explosiveness, was productive in college at a very young age, and now is with the Baltimore Ravens, who are going to be very run heavy. And so I think he has potential, even if he doesn't become the lead back. But if he becomes the lead back, I think he could just blow up. And then another guy is a sixth rounder, Tre'Mion Williams, out of Texas A&M, was hugely productive, the lead back there all three seasons. Came out early as a junior, isn't incredibly athletic, but I think is athletic enough. And if Joe Mixon is to suffer an injury, I think Tre'Mion Williams would be the guy who would be able to come in. And he has a three down skill set where I think he really could be the lead back. So those would be the two guys I would go with that I could kind of see them potentially coming out of nowhere. This was a good episode. It was a beefy episode. What are you guys working on for the upcoming week?
I'm going to continue. I just put out I'm sure you guys saw the Mahomes piece. I'm sure you saw the 10 fades. I'll have a 10 or I don't know if it's going to be 10, but I'll have a similar piece on the guys I like. And I also have a piece on the Giants and their dysfunction with Gettleman and all those guys.
This week, I just came out with my piece. I plugged last week the 18 games I found value on for weeks 2 through 17 lines that are up. I applied my initial season power ratings and some game theory where teams will sort of be trending at certain points of the season. So check that out. And I'm doing a little side project with Chad Millman where I'm capping NBA 2K19 games that he's simulating. So having some fun with that and going to be rolling out some content this week on that.
It sounds like a fantastic use of your time.
Especially in May.
That is like the ultimate off-season project. You know, like it's football, we can think about that a little bit later. Right now, I need to focus on basketball video games.
Yeah, especially when the wife's asking me, you know, we're getting ready to leave, and she's like, what are you doing? Get over here. And, you know, I'm like, oh, I'm simulating this Golden State Warrior game on PlayStation, so... Really awkward conversation material right there, but
yeah, it's good. It looks like you're playing a video game. That's right, I am, and it's for my work. So, okay, the off season rolls on. We will have another episode next week. Till then, that is going to do it for this episode of the Action Network NFL podcast. Please rate and review the show in iTunes. For Sean and Chris, I am Matthew Friedman, Matt at the Oracle. See you again next episode.